And stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Later on in the hour, Park City Planner Rebecca Ward, along with Affordable Housing Manager Jason Glidden, have a preview of tomorrow's Park City Planning Commission meeting. And Summit Land Conservancy Outreach and Education Director Caitlin Willard, along with Conservation Director and Counsel Kate Saddlemeyer, talking about some of the open space issues they're tracking. First, taking a look at some local news, the Summit County Board of Health heard yesterday that the surging numbers of COVID cases are not good news, but they were not a surprise coming after Thanksgiving. Summit County Health Director Rich Bola said there is a silver lining to Summit County's numbers compared to surrounding communities.
The health director reported that as of December 6th, the county had 2,454 cases, 93 total hospitalizations, and 5 deaths. Bolo said trends are heading in the wrong direction, but it's no surprise they saw the first large surge about 6 days after Thanksgiving. He said that before the holiday weekend, Summit County saw 45 cases per 100,000 population and an 11% positivity rate. As of Monday, they had 84 cases per 100,000 and 18% positivity. Board member Chris Cherniak also noted that 61% of their cases come from residents 44 years of age or below, indicating that the younger population is driving the surge. Below said one scary statistic is that looking back over the entire pandemic period, 15% of the cases have occurred just in the past 14 days. Still, he noted that Summit County is doing better than its neighbors.
While our cases have surged significantly to about 84 per 100,000, just to our south, Wasatch County is at about 138 per 100,000. The state is significantly higher than we are. Utah County remains high. So we're too high. We're surging. It's a problem. We're surging at the wrong time. But the behaviors of Summit County residents in general, I believe, and when I say residents, I include businesses, deserve a shout out.
He said he's hoping that their case numbers will stay flat or even decline by Christmas.
We were rocking it not much more than about a week ago. Our rates were still high, but they were trending downwards. Then Thanksgiving hit. We, a few days after Thanksgiving, moved into incidence increase. And, you know, again, it was anticipated. My hope is that we can enter a period of incidence plateau and then incidence decline building into the Christmas season. But this is really dire, and we need to ask the public to consider those gatherings, consider how we group as individuals, considering obviously that we've got holiday seasons, and that means getting together with family.
Meanwhile, the numbers on ICU capacity in hospitals are also worrisome. A graph showed that in October, the state climbed above the so-called utilization warning level of 77%. Bola said some days they are hitting 96% capacity. And of the occupied ICU beds, 40% are COVID-related, which Bola said is extremely concerning. Also during Monday's meeting, Health Board member Doug Evans raised a concern. He said that some relatives had had contact with people who were positive for COVID-19, but his family members were told by Intermountain Healthcare representatives that they couldn't get tested unless they were sick or showed symptoms.
This whole family, my daughter's family, had been exposed. And I said, well, you're going to have to call them and lie to them and tell them that you all have symptoms. And as soon as they did that, they scheduled them to come and get a test.
Other health board members said they had been given similar information or they heard from county residents who got the same message. Bolo said that isn't what he has been told.
I've been told repeatedly, so this is news to me right now, Doug. I've been told repeatedly up until only about a week ago that if you communicated, first of all, you've got to go online and you've got to, or through the phone, and you've got to get a reservation to be tested. If you tell them that you are a direct contact of a confirmed case, I've been consistently told that you will receive a test.
He said he will follow up on the issue with IHC. Bolo added that fortunately, state government took bolder action as the holidays approached and called for a universal mask mandate. But in answer to a question, he said it wouldn't help for Summit County to adopt more stringent standards by itself because a majority of their workforce comes from surrounding areas. Billow said they'd have to take a regional approach to be effective. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
It's 8:15. Good morning. The Summit County Council meets virtually tomorrow starting at 2:15. On the phone with a preview, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom. Hi there. I think I got you on the right pot now. Anyway, at 2:20, okay. A discussion on planning for surges in hospital. What is our ICU capacity at this point? Do we know?
You know, I'm not particular, in that level of detail familiar with that. You'd have to contact IHC themselves to get that detail. But as has been projected by IHC, by the health department, by the state emergency managers that are following this, you know, they're managing the capacity by the whole system. Our hospital systems are working together. We have surge hospitals that are taking COVID patients specifically, so that allows other hospitals to cover other emergent care. So I kind of know it from that broader perspective, but not the details.
So do we know what hospitals will do if we should breach that capacity? I mean, do they start turning away like me because I'm older?
Certainly they've already started backing out of non-emergent care and postponing that type of stuff. Certainly we've been reading in the paper over the past month to 2 months about when they start to reach capacity, how they start to determine and separate out different types of care that they can offer. Especially on the emergent side. They have to put those protocols in place, and they are in place. Whether they're doing that at this point or not, I'm sure we're going to get very similar questions to Dr. Province tomorrow.
Okay, so what is it the county is planning for?
Well, this item on the agenda is not for county planning per se. Mm-hmm. This is to bring awareness to what the hospital system in the state is doing and how that system is planning in order to deal with the surge.
Okay. More discussion of the Dakota Pacific application for the property at Kimball Junction. The applicants will present an analysis of economic impact. 12 years ago, the Boyer Tech Park promised that it would generate economic diversity, and that didn't pan out. So should we expect Dakota to show how this project will weather the ups and downs of the economy?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's necessarily about how it would weather the ups and downs of an economy. It's more projecting, I would expect, if they are allowed to develop, what the impact of that development would be on the economy, based on the mix of uses that they're asking for. The difference with the tech park, obviously, is that it did not develop out. So there were two buildings built, but the economic impact of that would be different than some other type of development and mix of uses. So I'm sure that's what the discussion will be about.
So I thought the rule, if you will, was that we didn't approve or deny projects based on their economic viability. I mean, that's not the county council's job. It's the market's job, no?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think certainly, probably because the tech park and its current use, which is what really is being challenged, is the current use table, had a specific purpose in mind. It's probably apropos. What you're not going to hear, I've never heard this in a discussion at the county council or the planning commission level here, is, you know, kind of the idea of how much tax generation there would be from that type of development or that mix of uses that is being proposed. That's the part that is less appropriate.
Also, a discussion with regard to sustainability. The applicants claim their project with affordable housing will be a benefit because workers won't have to commute here from elsewhere. Can you talk about some of the other green features then?
Well, I'm certainly going to let the applicant talk about their features. But what has been expressed in the past by the Planning Commission and Council is not only that commuter effect and all that comes with that, whether it be traffic or greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles or those types of things. Certainly the building materials around a project like this, the way that buildings are built, sometimes you hear, LEED standards or high performance building standards and how they could be applied, or even different ways of heating and cooling a building, as well as even power generation if there's solar involved. All of those types of things can be talked about under the sustainability umbrella.
So what's your guesstimate of when Dakota gets to a public hearing?
I would guess that we're going to see a public hearing in January.
Okay. Also on the agenda, resolution to issue and sell up to $20 million in bonds based on sales tax. I'm assuming this is from the transit sales taxes?
No, this is related to, this has nothing to do with transit sales taxes. It would be from our general sales taxes. This has to do with the fact that we've just retired some building bonds that were probably a 10-year bond. That frees up some capacity to deal with some of the issues that we have with future facilities that are projected in our facilities master plan. Things around public works, around our public safety programs, and then if we do end up expanding space in order to move some functions around, what we would do with that space that we're freeing up and remodeling that.
And given kind of the decline in the general sales tax, is this an issue for the county?
Well, I mean, like I said, we're at a point where we're a bond has matured, so that frees up some expenditure capacity. We're taking all of that into consideration with projections of sales taxes in order to suggest this bond level. And it can also be structured in a way that bond payments would be less in the beginning years and more in out years to account for what we're experiencing with the economic impact of this pandemic.
Okay. And these are the projects, again, that we've kind of talked about before with regard to the public works facility there in Wanship and
that's
possibly
correct. And some possible facility expansion around the Justice Center.
Right. Also, a discussion and possible approval for a 2021 work plan. The staff report says you've decided not to set any big new priorities for the new future. So what priorities are you recommending that the county continue?
Well, we're certainly continuing on our track with the strategic plan. Everything around transportation, sustainability, affordable housing, making sure our planning code, general plans are where the community wants to go, as well as our mental health plans. And so a lot of the work is around that. As you'll remember, during the current year, we slowed down on a few of our projects to account for not only the effects of the pandemic, but other unknowns. Particularly the hideout issue took a tremendous amount of staff time and council time this year. So knowing that we're going to have some of those things still affecting our total ability to complete work in 2021, we've adjusted our ambition just a little bit. Are going to spread some of those ambitions out over a couple to 3 years as opposed to one, and really try and hone in on the things that are most important to the county to get done in 2021, as well as take care of the effects and finish out, hopefully, the effects of the pandemic on our workforce as well as the community.
Yeah. You mentioned hideout. Can you give us any updates on what's happening there?
Nothing really new that I know of since the last lawsuit that was filed by the county. I think we're all kind of waiting to see what happens with signature gathering. I'm not completely familiar with where that is at this point.
Okay. And then what about completing the trail along State Route 32? Is that part of the 2021 work plan?
So in a way it is. So we're at the point with the information and studies that have been done on that up until this point in conjunction with the South Summit Trails Group that we can complete the design in 2021, and we plan on doing that. Interestingly enough, I just saw an email this morning from the state about some grant programs around economic development and public recreation that could be possibilities to fund a project like this. So, you know, we're going to go through that process with our engineering department. We're going to design that in-house this year, have it on the shelf, and then start looking for the opportunities on how to fund that.
And the staff report lists a category called the unknown of the unknown. What's this, or can we possibly know?
Well, you know, it's become, you know, certainly 2020 was the example of the great unknowns and how they were going to affect what county government could do, and really all levels of government. I'm not just saying it's special to us. The pandemic, we did not know how much time and effort we were going to have to spend on that when we were designing the work plan and the budget for 2020. Hideout wasn't a thing to us at that point. And then, you know, littler things, you know, relatively speaking, like an earthquake or a flood or fires that have come up. You know, we have to give ourselves the ability to adjust our work plan and build some space into our yearly activity to account for those types of things, because they do come up every year. And it's just we can't put a name to them when we pass the budget in December of this year.
And then at 6 o'clock, a public hearing to change the county fee schedule. The major item here, of course, is raising the annual trash fee from $40 to $60. You said that even with this increase, it's still much lower than other locales. Have we heard from the public about this at all, or is that what we'll hear about on Wednesday?
Well, I mean, certainly the public hearing will still be open in regards to this, or I think it was a briefing item last week, and now it's a public hearing. We expect to hear about that. You know, in gathering information this past week at the request of the council, we're seeing ranges of communities around us that are charging $180 to above $200 a year for collections per can. So, you know, I don't think the increase is out of the realm of possibility. It's for me probably more about continuing the discussion about how we fund this service, how ambitious we want to be with it, and where we want it to be in the future. And all of those have to come together at some point. At this point, you know, while we're talking about the next contract and getting that out to RFP in 2021, if we want to significantly pay for that with fees in the future, we need to keep ratcheting it up.
All right. And then the county buddy and county budget in general, what's the schedule on this? I mean, are we voting on it this week or next week?
We should be voting on it this week. You know, the usual schedule when we're meeting in person is that we have a hearing on both sides of the county. So one at the Richens building, one in Colville. We followed that model, even though we're doing it all electronically. This gives the public and the council 2 weeks to consider the final resolution and the final detail of the budget. So this would be the second meeting where the public hearing will still be open. So we encourage anybody that has any questions or comments concerning the overall county budget for next year to be present and make those questions or comments known.
All right. And then real quick, the basic numbers for us. I mean, maybe better yet, a comparison of how this year's budget compares to last year.
Sure. I'll compare it in two ways. So we're just above $57 million in the total operations budget proposed for 2021. That's about 2.5% more than the amended or adjusted 2020 budget, but a little under 7% less than the original 2020 budget. So we're certainly increasing spending a little bit based on what we can project in our revenues, but not even close to where we were budgeting for 2021 when we passed the budget in December of 2019.
Okay. So if people have something to say about the budget or the proposed increase in the trash fee, they should plan to log on.
Absolutely. All the information is available on our website in order to obtain the agenda and get that link. It's at summitcounty.org.
Okay. Tom, anything you wanted to mention?
That's all I've got today.
Thanks for your time. That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Park City Planning Commission meets virtually tomorrow night starting at 5:30. On the phone with a preview of the agenda, I have City Planner Rebecca Ward along with Affordable Housing Manager Jason Glidden. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
First up, the Land Management Code amendments. Early this year, the Planning Commission prioritized amendments to the code for affordable housing, sustainability, transportation, connectivity, and a general plan update for Bonanza Park to make way for the Arts and Culture District. Then the pandemic hit, Rebecca. So how much did the staff and Planning Commission get accomplished?
So this year, we have moved forward with the affordable housing land management code amendments, which are scheduled for a work session tomorrow evening. Those are still in progress, and we hope to have those finalized in early 2021. We've also been working with the Community Advisory Committee on the sustainability land management code amendments for net zero development, and those meetings have been ongoing since March of this year and will be wrapped up in the spring of next year. So we hope to have some code amendments in the summer that will address sustainability in some of the development reviews. And we've also put into place electric vehicle charging station requirements for new development and are working on the dark sky amendments, which are in progress, and active transportation connectivity. So we have seen some of those amendments adopted, and we'll continue to move forward with these projects into 2021.
Okay, so for 2021, do we set up a kind of a new plan, work plan, or do we just need to finish off what we've started here?
At this point, we're finishing off what was initiated this year.
All right. With regard to the affordable housing changes, the city has reduced setbacks, open space and parking requirements. The idea is that private developers had one step forward to build affordable projects. Has this happened, or is this just really being done to make it easier for the city to accomplish its goals with its projects? Jason, I don't know, or Rebecca?
Yeah, I think I could update that. I think that, you know, we're trying to use these as a tool to incentivize private participation, whether that be just on their own or through a public-private partnership. That's the intent of these. It's not necessarily the intent just for city projects.
Okay, but have we seen any success with the changes that we've made? I mean, are we seeing folks step forward to say, okay, now we can afford to do this?
I think that we've had some interest in developers looking at it, saying, "Hey, you're moving in the right direction, and these are the things that we need to see changes in to make it more financially feasible for us." And this is the next step in doing that. And some of the feedback we've gotten from some of the local developers that we've talked to is that we're getting there. I don't know if this is going to get us 100% there, but it's definitely going to incentivize enough, probably, for a public-private partnership to occur.
All right, well, let's stick with it. It's later on in the agenda, but there are more amendments to the Land Management Code on master planned affordable housing developments, again, to reduce off-street parking, to increase building height, and to allow market rate and affordable units. What would these amendments do that the current code, you know, hasn't done?
So this is the second phase of these Land Management Code amendments, and last year we had a third-party consultant who created a report for us to understand what we need to do to make these possible for private developers and for public-private partnerships. And we separated the code into two phases. And as you mentioned, the first phase reduced open space and setbacks and parking. This is the second phase. We're working to create a balance between market rate units and affordable units so that these projects can move forward. And this is the last step in that phase to see what else we need to address in the code. We're considering adding some mixed use where there could be potentially some commercial development on the first floor of these developments. We're recommending that nightly rentals be prohibited. And then we're also working through the final details of how this code would fall into place for these future projects that we're hoping to incentivize.
Okay, Jason, can you kind of give us an update where we are with the city's goal to build the 800 affordable housing units by 2026?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, we have the goal of 800 units by 2026. And currently right now we've completed 133. We had an interim goal of 220 by 2020. Obviously, it looks like we're going to fall short of that, but we have an additional 400 units or so that are upcoming units, meaning that they're in plans, and that could be either through some of the forecasted city developments that we're looking at doing, along with some of the private developments that will have a housing requirement associated with them.
Okay, so we're talking about those 400. Those would include Woodside Park Phase 2, the Homestake units. Where else?
Well, when you have the resort, obviously Park City Resort, the redevelopment there, they'll have a housing requirement. Deer Valley, looking to possibly, look at their base resort and do additional development there that would have a housing requirement. There's some other larger projects that are coming that are forecasted to come in that would possibly have a requirement for housing. So those are additional ones that we're looking at. I think you mentioned the big ones for the city.
Okay. Let's see. Also during work session, Planning Commission will consider updates to the city's outdoor lighting regulations to align with Summit County's recently adopted code, as well as the International Dark Sky Association. In the packet, there was like some 40 pages of public comment here. So we've got some people pretty concerned about this, it sounds like. Rebecca?
Yeah. We've had a lot of public input. It's the majority has been very enthusiastic about the amendments that are proposed. We also had a survey that we created through the Engage Park City page, and we had over 300 participants. And so we've had great input from the community. We've done our best to incorporate their concerns in the draft code. In the work session tomorrow, we're hoping to wrap up some of the final details of the code with the Planning Commission, and then we'll bring the proposed amendments to the Commission again in January 13th. So on our Engage Park City page, we would love more public input. We always look forward to hearing the thoughts on what's proposed.
Okay, I see there is an exception for seasonal lights, but if we want to protect the night sky, then why allow seasonal lights? I mean, if we want dark skies, we should turn the lights off.
So with the seasonal lights, we are proposing some additional restrictions where right now the lights are allowed November 1st through April 15th. We're proposing to reduce that to March 1st, and then lights can be on until midnight. We're recommending that be reduced to 11 p.m. and that seasonal lights comply with setbacks and don't cause light trespass. The one exception that we're carving out is for Main Street, Sweet Alley, and some buildings in the general commercial zone, where to reflect existing conditions on Main Street and Sweet Alley, those string lights outlining buildings would be exempt from the timeline, but would be required to be turned off by 2:30 a.m.
Okay, so like the city's lights there in the center strips along Bonanza Drive, those would have to be turned off as well? Put on a timer?
That's correct, yes.
Let's see. What about the public input that you've received from folks who would like to see some restriction on the hillside homes, especially where we have homes with a lot of glass and their lighting is seen far and wide?
Yeah, we have received a lot of input on lighting that is on the ridgeline areas, on steep slopes. We've been looking into other codes to see how communities address that. Right now, we are mirroring what Summit County has in place, and this phase of the code addresses the outdoor lighting. In the future, we might look into potential indoor lighting mitigations for those developments on ridgelines.
And what about just the next door neighbor who keeps his or her bright light on all night? I mean, they're a renter. They're not going to change the fixture. They're not going to go out and get a timer for it. How do we deal with those folks?
So what we're proposing is citywide compliance by the end of 2024. And in the meantime, what we've found, we've had some great participation in some community Zoom meetings where we've had several instances of community members voicing concern about neighbor lighting, and then we hear back a couple days later that they spoke to their neighbor, the neighbor addressed the issue, wasn't even aware of the issue. But we're hoping that as this code is put into place, it's another name for dark sky ordinances that sometimes you'll hear is good neighbor lighting. And we're hoping that as these amendments go into place, that future development will mitigate these impacts, and that through this code, we can work to make sure that impacts are mitigated for existing lighting as well.
Yeah, and what about those who have installed those fancy glass garage doors? That's the trend, spilling out lots of light. How do we?
Yeah, we have heard some concerns about the garage door lighting, and that is, like I said, this code addresses specifically the outdoor lighting. But we are considering another phase that would go to address the indoor lights as well.
Okay. And then does this impact the resorts? We've got nighttime lighting there without even night skiing anymore.
That's correct. So this phase exempts recreation lighting to the extent that it's regulated under the existing code. And so at this time, we're not proposing any changes for the recreational lighting, but we do understand that there are some projects that are in process that will help mitigate some of those impacts.
All right, so a great idea, but how do we enforce all of this? I mean, again, we'll just have to turn to our neighbors and ask for their compliance?
So we're working to, as soon as this code goes into place, it will apply to all new development. And then we're working with a plan for the next several years to provide information and to provide, sending out mailers, creating a website to help community members come into compliance. We have heard from some community members that they're interested in helping with outreach on this. We may have an opportunity to work with University of Utah Dark Sky Consortium next semester for them to help us with outreach and determining where we are right now with the city's light pollution and where we want to go. So I think this will definitely be a process of public education, making sure that we have resources available on how properties can come into compliance, and doing everything we can to help those property owners between now and the end of 2024.
Okay, Rebecca, Jason, anything else you'd like to add?
For more information on both the affordable land management code developments for affordable housing and the outdoor lighting amendments, you can visit engageparkcity.org.
Okay, Rebecca Ward, Jason Glenn, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
On the phone now with an open space update from Summit Land Conservancy, I have Kate Settlemyer, Conservation Director and Counsel, along with Caitlin Willard, the Outreach and Education Director. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Caitlin, let's start with you. Live PC, Give PC, a big day for Summit Land Conservancy, it sounds like. You were one of the top moneymakers.
Yeah. Live PC, Give PC was great this year. The Summit Land Conservancy is so grateful to our community for the support that we received during Live PC, Give PC last month. In 24 hours, we raised over $150,000, including our matching grants from more than 590 open space enthusiasts. This huge showing of support helped us place third on the master leaderboard, and it qualified us for one of those prize grants. We just want to say thank you again to everyone. Despite this pandemic, people are still giving, and we are humbled by everyone's enthusiasm and dedication toward local land conservation.
Well, another good end to 2020, despite all that's happened, Kate, were two completed land conservations in the last month. Tell us about those.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Leslie. Look, we're very excited about these two projects that closed just in the last couple of weeks. We have our Marchant Meadows, which is a completely new thing for us. It's 106 acres that we're planning to own long-term, very different structure for us. The Weber River runs through this property twice, and extra streams and wetlands. It's agricultural land that we're looking to open up to public access for, you know, passive recreational trails, and we're really excited about that project. And then we've completed our River Bend Park transaction with partnering with Oakley City. So we'll also see that open for access along the river in the years to come.
Yeah. So what happens to the property now? It just stays open and you'll manage it?
Yes. It's, you know, we're taking on, you know, a brand new thing, lots of work to do. We're partnering this is for Marchant Meadows. We are partnering with the NRCS, significant federal funding, and it's a new kind of conservation easement called a wetland reserve easement, which is more restoration focused. So, you know, the property has been grazed. It was a foundation family. We're very honored to be working with them, the Marchant family. They've been grazing the property for 100 years or so. And we'll see some grazing, just different kind of grazing, more restoration, more of a regenerative grazing, and, you know, an opportunity for people to get out along the river, you know, part of the Oakley River Corridor project.
All right. The Conservancy was also awarded a grant recently from Park City Community Foundation. How much and what's that for?
Yes, we're honored. That was $25,000 from the Climate Fund Initiative, aimed at, you know, the city's carbon sequestration goals. So in the past couple of years, you've probably noticed some changes around the McCollin Farm. You've seen cows out there, like a small group of cows being shifted around to different parts of the property every couple of days. That's part of our regenerative grazing initiative. Really, it's Bill White Farms. Thank you to Bill White Farms and Park City Municipal. And what this project does is it really, you know, focuses on soil health, like regenerative agriculture, you know, improving, big improvements to irrigation on the property also. And there's a, you know, a large research component, because, I mean, we all know that the forest in the Amazon sequester, you know, a large amount of carbon, but we don't know so much about carbon sequestration in the West. So we're hoping that, you know, we collect data from this project and hopefully replicate it.
Okay. And then, Caitlin, we've got an upcoming screening, I guess, that explains everything that Kate was just talking about in terms of this regenerative agriculture.
Yeah, we actually have an upcoming panel discussion. So the screening happened this past weekend through the Park City Film Series, and it's a film called Kiss the Ground, which is a full-length documentary narrated by Woody Harrelson. And it highlights this new approach to farming and the potential it has to balance our climate and replenish our water supplies and feed the world. So if you missed the movie, you can actually still catch it on Netflix, or you can go to the Kiss the Ground website and watch it there for a dollar. So what we decided, since the film is so incredible, that we wanted to hold a panel discussion so people can kind of ask questions and get more involved and learn more about it. So we're holding that in partnership with the film series, Park City Municipal, Swanner, and Recycle Utah. And we put together a group of four panelists, including Summit Land Conservancy's own land protection specialist, Brett Denny. And then we have Craig McKnight of Bill White Farms, Andrea Morgan of Renewing Gardens, and Dr. Jennifer Reeve from the Organic Sustainable Agriculture Department of Utah State University. The discussion is going to start at 6 p.m. tomorrow night, and it will be moderated by Mel Larson, one of our favorite executive directors from the Solano Eco Center. And people interested in attending this discussion can visit our Facebook event page, our webpage, or parkcityfilm.org to register.
Okay. Let's see. You guys in your new offices yet?
Yes, we do. Our office is great. Fantastic. Yes, we're happy to have found ourselves a permanent home.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to mention?
I just want to say if you want to check out what we're doing at Summit Land Conservancy, you can always go to our website, wesaveland.org, and learn more about us.
Okay. Kate Saddlemyer, Caitlin Willard, thanks for your time this morning. Well, Utah-based LGBTQ nonprofit Encircle has announced plans to build their fourth facility in Heber City. Heber was wrapped up in controversy over the pride banners that were flying down Main Street during Pride Month in the last 2 years, and Encircle founder and CEO Stephanie Larson saw an opportunity to provide support to a community in need. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
When Encircle founder and CEO Stephanie Larson was younger, she probably wouldn't have thought her career would take her in the direction it has. A native of Orem and a graduate of Brigham Young University's undergraduate program and J. Reuben Clark Law School, she says her views on LGBTQ issues were quite different than they are now.
When I left BYU, I had very black and white views about family and about what it meant to be LGBTQ. And at the time, I probably would have told you that being gay was a sin and a choice.
Larson moved to Washington, D.C. to work on Capitol Hill after graduating and helped write legislation aimed at protecting the traditional family. Then she met her future husband and his uncle, Utah restaurateur John Williams, who was gay. Larson says Williams challenged everything she thought she knew.
Getting to know John changed all of my views in life, basically. You know, it knowing John and realizing that he was one of the most Christ-like people I had ever met, and it made me question how would I ever judge him for his sexuality. So I think that, you know, the views I had towards traditional marriage and being gay, you know, over a 10-year period changed greatly.
Williams was tragically killed in a house fire in 2016. Larson returned to Utah in the mid-2000s and was alarmed at high suicide rates of LGBTQ youth, which prompted her to found Encircle in 2016. The organization opened their first home in Provo on Valentine's Day in 2017. They have since opened two other homes in Salt Lake City and St. George and announced a fourth would be coming to Heber in 2021. Heber was embroiled in controversy over the last 2 years when LGBTQ pride banners flew down the city's main street during Pride Month. Many people commended the move, and many others condemned it, accusing the city of taking sides on a political issue. Heber passed a new street banner policy earlier this year, limiting the content that is allowed on street banners, but leaving the door open for city-sponsored pride messages in the future. Larson says many Wasatch Back residents were already commuting to other Encircle houses, and building a facility in Heber was a natural next step. Encircle provides a safe space for members of the LGBTQ community. The organization also offers weekly programs for parents of LGBTQ youth, as well as art and music classes. Larson says all of Encircle's programs are aimed at promoting good mental health for the LGBTQ community.
The idea originally was we want these youth to have a place that feels like home, looks like home, for so many who maybe don't feel at home either in their own homes or at school or church or in their communities. And so, you know, we wanted this to be a place where they could feel loved and accepted and celebrated for who they are.
The Heber facility will be built over the course of the next several months and will cost an estimated $350,000. Larson says the biggest takeaway she's seen when opening a new house is how many people come out of the woodwork to support the programs.
You know, what I think I've seen happen around these homes is the community shows up and helps make it all possible. You know, I feel like I get to see the best in people every day, people volunteering their time to help serve these youth. You know, parents coming and learning how to be better parents, you know, with and help their children. And, you know, volunteers coming to help these kids do homework or make cookies and just, you know, let them know that they're loved.
To learn more about Encircle and the upcoming house in Heber, visit encircletogether.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.